bunch of people are working around the clock to plan for the possible return to school facilities on August 18th. It'll require creativity, persistence, and maybe a bit of luck to get it right.
LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner in a video statement this week. So, yeah, school begins in less than 2 months. Just what that will look like, well, that's unclear. School districts across the nation are figuring out how to transition back to classrooms and when. Meanwhile, the results are in on how distance learning has fared so far, and let's just give it a C-minus, maybe a D-plus. Tonell Hobbs is a national education reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she reported on this. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. So, Tonell, give us an overview of how distance learning went so far.
Distance learning got really low marks from school districts throughout the country. And the problem was you had millions of students who were in school districts and states where these entities did not even trust their remote learning programs to issue grades to students. The issues were mainly centered on so many students not being able to get online or having devices to learn at home. And also you had teachers who struggled to teach remotely. They hadn't really had training. And then you had parents who just could not be there to homeschool their kids because they had either work obligations, and in some cases they had just multiple kids and it was just too overwhelming.
Right. And I think you quoted someone who said we were building the plane as we were trying to fly it. So it was very difficult to all of a sudden transition to this. And it was all of a sudden. Now right. That teachers and school districts have had an opportunity to figure it out, at least partially, could it be better in the fall, distance learning?
You know, I would be surprised if it wasn't better. I don't know how much better. Because right now districts realize, okay, we have to get these kids outfitted with laptops. We have to get them online. We have to get the teachers trained. I think the biggest obstacle other than, you know, there's still teachers that, and there's superintendents too, that feel like it's just not going to be able to match in-person learning. But I think they feel that we can learn from the lessons in the spring and make it better. The big issue that they will face is that as more parents go back to work, that means that they're not going to be able to be around for remote learning. So that's something that they're going to have to deal with.
So what are they talking about? Are they talking about a mix of in-person and remote learning in most districts, including LA's?
That is the most popular method. You know, I talked to LAUSD and they're not really, they said there's no decision been made yet on how they might return to school. But, and then they had also said it's just not as simple as, you know, wearing a mask and moving desks farther apart. There's obviously they want to focus too on testing and contact tracing. So LA has kind of been very cautious about how they might return to schools. But from what I'm hearing throughout the nation, the preference seems to be on a mix of in-person and remote learning.
And here in LA, most kids who needed them were given laptops. So at least there's that.
Right, exactly. And I would say that LA is probably, you know, there's obviously some districts where students already had district-issued laptops and they were farther ahead. But LA has definitely had to catch up. And it seems that they're there as far as making sure the kids have the devices. A lot of the concern right now with LA is, you know, just the virus itself and making right. sure it doesn't spread. But they have done a lot in the ways of getting kids outfitted with laptops.
Even though they have the laptops, though, how do you guarantee that they actually open them up and attend Zoom class?
That's another issue that LA is going to have to deal with. And they had actually looked at that with the high school kids and determined that even though some of them did have the laptops, as far as them actually getting on it and participating was another thing. There were some districts that didn't even bother doing attendance because it was just too, we're not even going to deal with that. I kind of sense in the fall, districts are going to be more focused on finding some way to take attendance, finding some way to make sure students participate.
And then there's the idea that's been called the COVID slide. Usually it's the summer slide because it's about losing the learning that you have and trying to catch up. But this is a lot longer. Kids just aren't learning as much now.
Yeah, it's like it's like the summer slide on steroids. You could have kids that haven't really had to do anything since March, because remember, there's a lot of school systems in some states that are not allowing zeros and Fs. So feasibly, you could have a child that since mid-March, when their school shut down, hasn't really done much in the way of lessons. And now here they are in August having to play catch up. So that's right there is going to be challenging, because some school districts are saying maybe we start back when the kids left off in March. And then there's others saying, no, we need to just keep plowing ahead and fill in the gaps as we go on along so that they're not starting already behind. So that will be interesting to watch to see how districts handle that.
Are they looking at other countries that have reopened their schools to see if they should import some of those lessons?
They definitely are. I know we had a story, I guess, not long ago, just looking at, the different methods that these other countries are using just to get the kids back in school. And it's totally different. If you look at some of the pictures, you get some kids that are, eating lunch, and they have like these glass partitions between them. And, I actually even, there's a district in, it's a small school. Really, it's in Montana, and they had opened up actually for the last 3 weeks of spring. And just looking at some of their methods, it's very challenging, they said, to social distance, especially like kindergarten kids. And one of the methods they used that I found interesting, they had hula hoops. Each of the kindergarten kids had a hula hoop, and that hula hoop, they could sit in that hula hoop, and that was kind of their safe space, and they could play with their blocks or do whatever, and do their lessons within that hula hoop. So you're going to see different methods roll out, but school districts are definitely looking internationally just to see how it's going there with some of those school systems opening up. And there's obviously concern about spread, and what do you do if you do have a student that is positive for coronavirus, the virus, then what do you do?
Yeah, do you shut the whole thing down or not? I mean, that
That's
would be very
the issue.
difficult.
But if you look right now, what we're seeing, even with some of the schools that are doing the summer football training, I've seen some of them shut down already because some of the players are coming up, with COVID. So is that going to be the answer? I mean, when school starts back up, do you shut the whole school down if, when one student tests positive, or what do you do? And that's something that they're also looking at. How do we address that? And they know it's probably inevitable that that will happen.
Tonnell Hobbs is national education reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Tonnell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's talk about college now. Even if students are willing to go back, some professors are not. In an open letter to her students, a professor at Goucher College, that's a liberal arts college in Baltimore, says she will not be there in person. She'll offer only online courses. Neosha Grayman Simpson is a professor of psychology and Africana studies. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, you've decided you will only teach remotely in the fall. How did you make that decision?
Well, in the letter to the students, I outline three driving motivators, one being public health considerations, two social justice considerations, and three pedagogical considerations. I always try to impress upon the students that we step into organizational spaces with philosophical frames that guide our moral and ethical decision making. And I saw this lethal pandemic as a perfect opportunity to impart that lesson once again, to show them how this philosophical frame actually shows up in a decision-making process.
So from public health concerns, that one seems pretty obvious. You're worried that you and your students might get infected?
Correct. And the public health and the social justice concerns overlap. When we think about who is most likely to be infected, the data shows that it's people of color and low-wage workers. So that is both a public health issue and a social justice issue. I think that my particular position as a somewhat politically conscious Black woman who is also raising a Black son gives me an insight into some of these considerations that may be board of trustee members, presidents and presidential cabinets, and even faculty leaders at predominantly white institutions don't necessarily consider, or they overlook in their calculus mm-hmm. on what they should do in the fall.
And are there other factors when it comes to the social justice question that you were thinking about when you wrote this letter?
Well, absolutely. Again, thinking of my position as the mother of a 10-year-old Black boy, the cousin and an aunt figure to teenage and young adult Black men, I couldn't help but also think about the research that is showing that Black men in particular feel vulnerable to them being perceived as additional threats when they are masked. And so I'm having visions of a small liberal arts college dimly lit at night, Black male students leaving dorms, leaving buildings masked, and the potential dangers that that could bring upon them.
Right. And so by writing this letter, were you hoping that you would encourage your students then to decide not to attend for these reasons?
So the goal was really to have them think through, to have them be curious about the decision-making process on the part of the organization, of the institution, on the part of faculty, on their own parts, and to be curious about their own frames that are guiding their decision making. So the goal is not to have them adopt my position and my standpoint, but to think through their own.
And what was the response to your letter? You published it in Medium. Did you get responses mm-hmm. from people all over the country, other teachers, other educators?
I did. I received responses from Vermont, from Georgia, from out west. And the responses were favorable. I also posted it on a listserv to which I belong, and it received over 200 favorable responses there. And so there is something about the contents of that letter that are resonating with faculty across the country, for sure.
Yeah. And I know in particular, older faculty members are concerned about their own health. Do you worry about other faculty members who may be in a risky group being asked to return back to the classroom?
I do. And I think that this is another element of a social justice consideration that I didn't pen in the letter, but it's something that I've thought about. Both the physical vulnerability of students and faculty and staff members, and or the requirement that some institutions are putting in place that be disclosed in order to receive permission to teach remotely. That troubles me. I think that even if unintentional, that there's a way in which people may end up being stigmatized within the organization. They may feel vulnerable. And so that concerns me as well.
Yeah. So you'll be offering online courses in the fall.
I will be offering online courses, Black psychology and counseling psychology, fully enrolled.
Mm-hmm. So we just heard in the previous segment that students were concerned, parents are concerned about the quality of online education, that it's not what they signed up for. They don't want to pay a full tuition in some instances when they're just going to get online education that's not as good as in-person learning. So how do you address those concerns?
Yeah, I understand those concerns. I think I initially shared that perspective and wondered if the quality of the education was less than what they would receive in person. I have changed my thinking about this. I don't think so. I think that it is a different medium of education, but I don't think the quality is less than. I think there are things that we can do with remote learning that we actually cannot do in person. And I'm taking this opportunity to explore those avenues with students and present an exciting new way to learn and also give them new tools that are going to be transferable, I believe, in the professional marketplace. And so as part of this experience, my students are going to learn a entirely new suite of technology tools that they would not have had to master in my in-person class.
Not to mention just learning how to conduct yourself on a video chat we don't know how to do that. We're all learning how to do that. And we're going to have to know how to do that when we go out into the workforce now.
Right.
Neasha Grayman-Simpson is a professor of psychology and Africana studies at Goucher College in Baltimore. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Coming up, from Aunt Jemima to Eskimo pies, corporations are scrambling to change their branding. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, Mozilla, Upwork, they're just some of the companies that have pledged to pull their advertisements from Facebook, at least temporarily. It's part of a Stop Hate for Profit campaign that started last week. And that campaign says Facebook, quote, amplifies the messages of white supremacists and permits the incitement of violence. With me to talk about that is Kevin Thomas. He teaches multicultural branding at Marquette University. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be here.
Well, there has long been calls for Facebook to do something about the hate on its platform, and this seems to be just the latest attempt to do that. Do you think this time it'll be successful?
Well, I think that's yet to be seen, right? So like the much like you said, we've been here before. Facebook has faced these types of allegations time and time again. There's been calls for boycott. There's been calls for policy change. And they seem to fizzle as their numbers of consumers on their platform grows. And so it'll be interesting to see now in this new environment, right, where we've got so many eyes on racial justice in this moment, this idea of holding corporate America accountable. It seems like this is a different moment. But I do think the jury's still out. When you think about why they're doing it, is it simply a putting their feet to the fire, kind of pandering to the audience? Or do we actually see them trying to make some systemic changes within? It's very early in this process. I am skeptical. A lot of these companies seem to simply be taking the lead from their peer institutions or simply kind of acquiescing to the demands of Black Lives Matter and other activist movements. And so it really is interesting to see how this plays out in the long term.
Yeah. Plus, it's only a handful of companies, and Facebook makes, what, like $70 billion in advertising a year from all sorts of different companies?
Correct. And it's simply for the month of July to start as well. So it does seem like it is much more kind of a forward kind of signaling to the public that there is this new change in interest around this topic without a whole lot of teeth behind it.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if that's the case in general when it comes to this, because we've seen a lot of focus from various brands on particular products like Aunt Jemima syrup and Uncle Ben's rice. That's all changing, or the look of it is changing. Is that more to just make the brands look good? Does it do anything?
Well, I think it goes back to thinking about who their consumers are, right? And so if we look at this instance with Facebook, a lot of the brands that we're looking at are brands that have a predominantly white consumer base, North Face, Patagonia, REI. But if you start to look at the moment, the push for racial justice isn't just about Black and brown bodies out protesting anymore. This is truly a multiracial, multicultural movement. If you look at information about Generation Z and Generation and Millennials, they really do expect their companies to not just espouse their values, but really operationalize them in their business. And so businesses are finding themselves in this position where they're expected by consumers to take a stand. And because white consumers make such a big part of that consumer base, so based on numbers alone, 2018, all consumers in the US had about $15 trillion in buying power. Right, but 82% of that is white consumers. And so it really does take that base shouting for change for these companies to move.
And when it comes to Facebook, would it come down to people canceling their accounts en masse for Facebook to change? Like, would it have to come from the other side rather than the advertising side, from the subscriber side, if you will?
Exactly. For this to be a sustained movement, it's got to be on the consumer side. The companies are not necessarily going to move on their own, right? These aren't altruistic moves. They are definitely looking at how is this going to impact their bottom line. And the moment that they see that consumers are moving away from Facebook, that's when they'll see the benefit of it, because it will be directly impacting their profit line.
What about politicians? We are in high campaign season now, and politicians spend a ton of money on Facebook. Do they have more of an obligation to look at Facebook and perhaps direct their money elsewhere?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plans out, right? So most of this push is coming from activist organizations on the left. And so it'll be interesting to see, are they simply focused on corporate America, or are they also going to hold politicians to the same standard?
And when it comes to changing the look of brands, we just discussed Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben, all that. What about inside the companies themselves? I mean, isn't that the more important move, to promote people of color, to make it a more diverse work environment?
Most definitely, right? That idea of it's a little bit easier. I mean, we've been waiting for quite a few decades for Aunt Jemima to actually catch up with the times and shift. But it is easier to make that change than to make the systemic change of really taking a hard look at your hiring practices. Companies have been grappling with diversity and inclusion for a very long time, and they've had a hard time actually successfully implementing simply diversity and inclusion. And now activists are saying, no, we don't want just diversity and inclusion. We want you to be anti-racist. And that requires not just providing space for people in the culture that exists, but actually changing that culture. And that does take a very long game, right? That's not something that can be done by the end of the year, which we'll see with the shift with Aunt Jemima. The link between marketplace and racism has not been studied by corporate America. And so I think the first step they're going to have to really understand that linkage, how entrenched racism has been through redlining and profiling and Jim Crow laws. And so the idea is to really take some time to really understand how their practices, which are rooted in white supremacy, have caused these inequities.
Why is it called Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben? What is the origin of that?
Yeah, so in both instances, this dates back to enslavement era, and it was not considered necessary to have any type of salutation that of respect for Black people, right? So there wasn't an idea of calling someone Mr. or Mrs. And so the best that we could do at the time was to be called an uncle or an aunt. And so marketers, seeing that, they decided and landed on Uncle Ben, because that they thought to call him Mr. would be going too far.
Huh, interesting. And maybe that's to make it more palatable for white consumers, like a friendly uncle.
Again, yeah, going back to the idea of who's our main consumer, companies didn't really even actually start to think about specifically targeting African-Americans until the 50s and 60s. So at the time, it was always about what's going to be palatable to white America.
Couldn't they have just called it Texas rice? I mean...
Good point.
Kevin Thomas teaches multicultural branding at Marquette University. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, a detailed look at the leader of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. He promises to modernize the kingdom while hanging on to his family's phenomenal wealth.
Cost, you know, just under $500 million. He apparently saw it floating off the southern coast of France while he was on vacation and said, I want that boat. It's a very nice place. It has speed boats. It has a grand piano. I think it has a climbing wall. There's a jacuzzi on one of the top decks that you can hang out in.
How MBS can reshape the Middle East. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Hajj. For months, there has been speculation about the annual pilgrimage to Islam's holiest site of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. 2.5 million Muslims participated last year. Well, this week, Saudi Arabia announced that only 1,000 pilgrims will be allowed to make the journey this year, none from outside the kingdom. So it's effectively canceled from anyone outside Saudi Arabia. It is yet another economic blow to Saudi Arabia, already suffering from low oil prices, and that could impede Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's plans to move beyond oil and turn his country into a global economic player. MBS has spent years consolidating his power, silencing dissidents, and even jailing his own mother along the way. Ben Hubbard writes about the life of the man in line to rule Saudi Arabia for the next half century in his new book. It's called MBS, The Rise to Power of Mohammed bin Salman. And I spoke with Ben, who's the Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times, a few months ago. All right, so MBS is young, relatively speaking. He's 34 years old, and the king has lots of sons who were in line. When did he become the clear favorite to become the next ruler?
Well, one of the problems with Saudi Arabia, you know, with understanding issues like this in Saudi Arabia, is that it's an absolute monarchy, and so it's not like the king is ever going to sit down for an interview and explain why he decided to choose this particular one of his sons. Many of his older sons are, I think, in a traditional sense, much, much more accomplished. They studied in the West. One of them was one of the first, he was the first Arab astronaut. Another one has a PhD from Oxford. They're very, very accomplished. MBS doesn't have any of these qualifications. His background was almost entirely inside the kingdom. Got a law degree at a Saudi university, and then he basically went to his father. And so, you know, we don't really know exactly why the decision was made, but it's clear from what we do know that he was very, very close to his father. He basically shadowed his father for many years, and his father came to trust him greatly. And so when it came time to choose among his sons the one who would inherit his power, he chose MBS.
Well, the Saudi royal family is famously wealthy, and some of the princes are, well, they live quite extravagant lifestyles. Where would you put MBS in this? Is he one of those that likes to flaunt his wealth?
Well, he started out not particularly wealthy. His father was not known to be a super wealthy prince, didn't have a lot of business interests, and neither did MBS. But soon after his father became king, we see him kind of go on this buying spree where, you know, money comes out of nowhere and So in a very short period of time, he makes a number of significant acquisitions. The famous one is this yacht, the Serene, which he bought actually from a Russian vodka magnate. And it cost, you know, just under $500 million. He apparently saw it floating off the southern coast of France while he was on vacation and said, "I want that boat." So he sent some of his aides to go down and negotiate it, and the ink was dry quite quickly the same day. It's a very nice place. I forget how many levels it is, but it has speed boats. It has a grand piano. I think it has a climbing wall. There's a jacuzzi on one of the top decks that you can hang out in. And, you know, he spends a lot of time on the yacht floating in the Red Sea. You know, his other famous purchases, he bought a gigantic palace outside of Paris, which is known as the world's most expensive home. You know, it was leaked that he was the buyer of the, you know, famous Leonardo da Vinci painting at Christie's auction house. Now, the Saudis and Mohammed bin Salman have denied up and down that he was the one that bought it, but pretty much everyone still believes that he did. So, you know, from somewhat, you know, lower ranks in terms of money in the royal family, he very much rocketed to the top and started dropping these huge sums on things.
And so, initially, MBS, he's seen as what? As you say, he's sort of an unknown quantity here in the West. Initially, how is he seen in Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi Arabia, you know, kind of depends on who you're talking to. I think it took people a little bit of time to realize what a force this guy was, but it became clear very quickly that he was out to do things that nobody had done before. You know, within a few months of, you know, his father becoming king, he becomes the defense minister, which puts him in charge of the military, and he launches a new military intervention in Yemen. Saudi had never really been in that kind of a war before. He starts talking about how important it is to diversify the Saudi economy away from oil. Then he starts talking about how he wants to change Saudi society, and he wants women to drive, and he wants to bring in entertainment and all of these things that Saudi Arabia had never been known for. And so it became clear pretty quickly that this was a young man with big plans, who was not going to waste any time in trying to do what he wanted to do.
Right. So he went on that famous charm offensive. He came here to Los Angeles as part of that, where he really wanted to sell this new version of Saudi Arabia to the West, that they were democratizing in a way, or at least opening up and liberalizing some of these old constraints, letting women drive. And they wanted movies in the kingdom and popular music. And they wanted to open it up for more business, as you say, privatize the national oil company. So initially, he was received with open arms in the West. I know he had a famously cold meeting with President Obama, but after that, this charm offensive, did it convince people that here was a guy that who was open to becoming a more democratic society?
I would call it democratic. I mean, he basically never spoke about political reform. He never sort of implied that Saudi citizens would have a say in how the country was ruled or that there would be any kind of democracy. But he wanted there to be a social opening, and he wanted there to be economic reform. These are basically the two main planks of his platform. And he really wanted the world to be involved in this. So the trip that you're talking about was in the spring of 2018. And this, it was a remarkable trip. He went to five states plus the District of Columbia. He met three former presidents. He had a meeting with Trump in the Oval Office. He had coffee at Starbucks in Manhattan with Mike Bloomberg. He flew to Seattle, saw Bill Gates, went to Silicon Valley, Mark Zuckerberg, Google. Then he went to Hollywood and he met, you know, it was just sort of this remarkable, remarkable trip, the number of people that he met. And at that point, plenty of people were interested in him. And you know, we didn't see a lot of new deals signed, and we didn't see a lot of new businesses saying, yes, we're going to put money into Saudi Arabia. But there was this curiosity and there was an enthusiasm about what he wanted to do. And a lot of people that really felt like, wow, if this guy's serious and he really does want to make these changes, maybe we want to be a part of that.
Right. But then came Jamal Khashoggi, which seemed to put an end to that.
There had been along the way a number of things that I think should have been some cause for concern. I mean, long before the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which was near the end of 2018, you had the Yemen war, which, you know, the Saudis intervened in 2015. You know, in 2017, you had this sort of bizarre detention and forced resignation of Saad Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon. And then you had this bizarre event of these hundreds of business people and princes who were locked in the Ritz-Carlton, accused of corruption, and he basically tried to take their money away. So for those of us in the region who were paying attention, we sort of saw the reforms he was talking about, and we saw these things that were getting people in the West excited. But we also saw these things happening inside Saudi Arabia that really sort of raised a lot of questions about his judgment and about just kind of his rash way of doing things. And then, you know, just becomes clear the longer that we watch him that, okay, we're going to have societal reform, we're going to have social opening, but this is going to happen at the same time as this authoritarian crackdown that is really going to put all of the power in Saudi Arabia into his hands.
And so is that what he saw in Jamal Khashoggi, a direct threat to his power?
So Jamal Khashoggi, you know, for those of us who had, you know, been in the Arab world for a long time and studied Saudi Arabia, Jamal Khashoggi, for the vast majority of his career, was part of the Saudi establishment. This was a guy who traveled with kings, traveled with princes. When I started covering Saudi Arabia in 2013, he was the guy that we would call whenever anything happened in Saudi Arabia because he could tell you what it meant. You would call him up and he'd say, oh, well, I think the king is thinking this, and I think that the government is worried about this. And he was a huge asset, I think, both for the Saudis and for people like me who were trying to figure out what was going there, because he served as this kind of bridge between the two. When MBS begins his rise, he actually considers Jamal originally a potential ally. He invites him to a reception and they have, you know, they sort of speak about these things. And I think he expects that Jamal is going to go off and write positively about all of this. And but once kind of the authoritarian side of MBS's rise kicks in, Jamal becomes very critical of it. He starts writing against it. The first falling out that they have is actually around President Trump. When Donald Trump won the election, the Saudis were quite shocked by it, and MBS and the royal court basically decided, we need to court this guy. It's very important for us to have a good relationship with him. And Jamal was very worried, and he wrote about it. He wrote a quite famous column at the time saying, you know, we don't need to be scared of Trump, but we need to prepare for him. He received a call from the royal court telling him, you need to shut up. We're going to cut you off. You're not allowed on social media. You're not allowed to appear on TV. You're not allowed to publish articles. And so it was not long after that that Jamal packed his bags, left the kingdom, and moved to the Washington, D.C. area, where he soon started writing for The Washington Post.
Right. And then the story of his unspeakably brutal murder and dismemberment inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. You have strong opinions that this was, in fact, orchestrated by MBS?
I don't see any reason to think that he didn't know about it. You know, there was a CIA assessment that was basically leaked to the media that I think is about right. I mean, they basically say there's no smoking gun. As far as I know, nobody, no intelligence service has a recording or has definitive proof of MBS ordering his guys, go get this guy for me. I don't think anybody has that. So in a court of law, it would be difficult to convict MBS of ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But over the course of his rise, we saw an escalating campaign against dissidents. It sort of started with the arrests at home. Then we started seeing different kinds of hacking attempts. There were a number of people who were literally kidnapped abroad and dragged back to Saudi Arabia to be put under sort of either house arrest or thrown in jail. So this is kind of accelerating in the background. And I just think it doesn't make a lot of sense if you know Saudi society. This is a very top-down kind of place. Everybody looks to the person above them. It's not a place where people take a lot of personal initiative. MBS is definitely not known for delegating his powers. And so I think a lot of people, including myself, just find it hard to believe that such a complicated operation could have happened without at least a nod from him. I mean, we had 15 agents fly from Saudi Arabia to Istanbul on private jets that were owned by the government. They stayed in hotels. They worked in the consulate beforehand. They brought along a bone saw in order to, you know, which they ended up using to dismember him. They brought along a guy who looked like Jamal Khashoggi, who could then go wander around Istanbul as a body double to try to confuse the surveillance cameras. I mean, this was not a last-minute operation that they threw together. This was quite extensive, and I think it's just quite hard to believe that somebody would have been able to pull together those kinds of resources for an operation like this without the Crown Prince at least having some idea what was going on.
Right. And he was worried himself, Jamal Khashoggi, about going back to Saudi Arabia. He wouldn't because he was afraid for his personal safety.
Right. Yeah. Once he moved to Washington, D.C., he was living in Tyson's Corner in Virginia, he basically realized that it would be dangerous for him to go back. I mean, he was still in touch with a number of Saudis. He still visited the Saudi embassy in Washington a number of times. He even met with the ambassador at least once, who happens to be a younger brother of MBS. And so he didn't believe that he was under threat, that they were going to come after him abroad. But he was definitely not ready to get on a plane and go back to Saudi Arabia.
So MBS is going to be in power for many decades. The United States has long had a close relationship with Saudi Arabia. How should the United States deal with them? How will the United States deal with him?
Well, yeah, there's pretty much every reason to believe that when his father passes away, he'll become king. And if he lives to be as old as his father, he could be king into the 2060s. And, you know, if you think about it on that kind of a timeline, the Obama administration was a blip. The Trump administration will be kind of a blip. You know, there's a big question about how future administrations are going to deal with him. And we've kind of seen, you know, Democratic and Republican administrations have both been willing to kind of look the other way at a lot of things coming out of Saudi Arabia. I do think it's the case, though, that after Jamal Khashoggi, we did see kind of an unprecedentedly broad sense of anger inside of the U.S. government. I mean, you have a lot of people in the State Department who have seen what's gone on in Yemen. They've seen what's happened in Saudi Arabia with these crackdowns and arrests, and they're not huge fans of him either. You've seen momentum build in Congress, and this is, you know, a bipartisan issue. You have people like Lindsey Graham, who, you know, usually stand with Donald Trump, have been very, very vocal about the Saudis. So it's hard to tell the future. You know, at the same time, the United States has a long history of dealing with dictators when we find it to be in our interest. So I don't know if it's going to be a huge change. But there is definitely leverage that the United States government has that it could use to try to push Saudi Arabia and try to push Mohammed bin Salman in the direction it wants. The question is if whoever is president decides to use those tools and to what end.
That's Ben Hubbard from The New York Times. He's the author of a new biography of Mohammed bin Salman. It's called MBS, The Rise to Power of Mohammed bin Salman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, summer camps are open, but is it a good idea to send your kids? We're going to talk to two camp directors about reopening next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you have children, chances are you and they are desperate for them to get out of the house. Now that it's summer, the prospect of being cooped up in the heat with nothing to do, well, it's not a pleasant thought for anyone. Usually, summer camp is the go-to, but these days, camps are allowed to open. But how can you mitigate the risk from a bunch of kids from a bunch of households and neighborhoods all coming together in a cabin around a campfire. Joining me to talk about this is Liz Kimmelman, owner and director of Tumbleweed Day Camp in the Santa Monica Mountains. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Also joining me is Devin Yates, artistic director at Theater 360, and that's a summer acting camp in Pasadena. Hi, Devin.
Hello.
Well, Liz, let's begin with you. What guidance have you received from the county in terms of how you can safely reopen?
So about 3 weeks ago, we received the LA County Department of Public Health protocols. They are about 6 pages long of varying different cleaning, sanitizing, and precautionary procedures that are intended for all sorts of day camps. So we received that, and that is on top of the guidance that we received not only from the state about a week before that, but in addition to CDC and guidance from the American Camp Association that had been released in May. So we are working with several varying documents that build upon each other to create the potential for the safest possible in-person experience that we could have.
Okay. So, Devin, what about you? Are you also following these strict cleaning protocols?
Absolutely. We haven't opened yet. We'll be opening later in July, and we'll be following all of the local and state guidelines, as well as creating some new ones because we're a performing arts camp, and that lends itself to a variety of different situations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, you're indoors, and so that poses a bigger risk than being outdoors. Second of all, you're on a stage, so I assume the kids will be working on the same stage. So how do you do that and maintain 6 foot distance and put on a play?
Yes. Well, we are very fortunate to, we have just moved into a new building, and we have a very large room that is about 1200 square feet, and it has a garage door. So we have worked with some local doctors to advise us as well on top of the guidelines. So by keeping the garage door open, we're going to create more of an environment that's healthier and safer with the air quality. As well as in that room, we can socially distance up to 8 feet. And we're creating these new kind of clear shower curtain cubicles for the students to actually sing in, because we were very worried about the projection of singing and the flow of what might come out. As every good actor knows, projection and enunciation is your friend. However, with COVID-19, it is not.
So I guess that means they don't have to wear masks when they're on stage.
When they're dancing, we're still going to have them wear masks. But when they are working in groups and doing a musical song, we will not have them wear masks. Correct.
So it sounds like you're going through quite a change, I guess, from previous years in terms of how you do things. Do you still see it, Devin, as a positive camp experience?
I do. We have been, like many different community organizations around the country, we've been hit really hard by COVID-19. And in the spring session, we transferred the in-person classes to virtual. And the number one thing that our parents are letting us know is their children are desperate for activity, action, interaction, being with their friends, and doing something they love. And we will be doing more than 100% in making sure the children are safe. And then when they leave us, they are safe coming home to their families.
Liz, what are you hearing from your families? Also that same level of desperation?
Yes, absolutely. We opened registration for our returning families, I think it was Friday the 12th, and we sold out for our older campers in 24 hours. I mean, it is just an overwhelming need for the interaction, the socializing, and also specifically for us here at Tumbleweed, we're 100% outdoors. So they're going to get the chance to be outside, to be in nature, to experience this place with peers and with that near-peer relationship for their camp counselors as well. I myself am a not just work at camp, but I'm a camp mom. So my daughter's coming here too. And just the thought of her being able to work with and listen to and learn from other adults is amazing. I can't express that enough. And then we also, too, have a huge amount of parents that without this possibility of returning to camp, they themselves cannot go back to work. So we really do see this similar to what Devin was mentioning, as it's a community good. They need the full-time care for their children. And so we're very lucky that we're able to provide that in such a open and safe way.
What happens if a kid does get sick? What will you do?
Yeah, so it's very clear in the LA County guidelines that if a person at camp, a kid or a staff member, comes down with sudden or unusual symptoms associated with COVID-19, we have to assume that they have COVID-19. And so it's a suspected case, and it lays out very clearly in the guidelines that they are to be sent home, and anyone that has come in close contact with them has to be sent home to quarantine for 14 days as well. So we are doing a lot of education with our families and our staff, specifically with the fact that we have to be very careful this summer, and we have to be partners this summer, because if one person gets sick, that means that the other folks in that group, including the counselors and the campers, also have to go home and quarantine.
Well, does that mean the whole camp is shut down?
Nope. It is, because we're able to social distance, we're really able to completely isolate our groups from one another here at Tumbleweed. We're on over 100 acres. The way that the protocols are set up and the safety guidelines are laid out is that our groups don't interact with other groups. So you kind of have this your own little household of 11 other campers and two counselors, and they go about their camp day together so that they're not interacting and they're not working with the materials of another group. They're not in close proximity to another group. And so we're able to control the effect that they have on the area, so that really what happens is those other 11 children and the two counselors have to go in quarantine, and there's a whole slew of guidelines and procedures for that as well. And then we need to sanitize and disinfect the areas that they've been in that day.
Devin, what about you? Do you have separate groups, or if one kid gets it, is that putting the whole camp at risk?
Yes, we have separated our camps into morning and afternoon sessions. So we are also able to control the amount of students coming in. So from a morning session, let's say from 9 to 12, we would only have 20 students there. And so if the unforeseeable would happen and unfortunate, then we would follow exactly what Liz was saying is what we have been sent in terms of all of the guidelines. We're doing, you know, so much more cleaning, temperature checking, and also working in partnership with our families.
You mentioned that this is a good way for kids to get out of the house and to de-stress from all of this quarantining. But I also wonder, Liz, if it's also stressful putting in all these protocols and having kids constantly reminded that, well, they have to be safe, even when they're trying to shake off all of the regular routine and just be free. They still have to wear masks. They still have to maintain distance.
Sure.
Is that also bringing in a certain level of stress that, well,
you know, that's a really
you've
great,
never had before?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We what we're finding is that myself and a couple of other of the executive director team members, we are taking on a lot of that stress. We are the ones that are going around and making sure that all of the behind the scenes action is happening, all the cleaning, the disinfecting, and the protocols and the procedures, down to the minute detail, so that the responsibility of the counselors is to ensure that their group is safe both physically and mentally. I mean, we're talking about a group of kids that have, for some of them, haven't interacted with other children for months. So we're going to be putting heavy emphasis on supporting our campers from a mental and social emotional learning standpoint. And so us on the executive team are taking on the heavy lifting of the protocols and the procedures and the cleaning so that they can focus on that, so that eventually when it comes down to the campers, the unusual things they're going to be experiencing are going to be washing their hands more and wearing face masks, but everybody's doing that. So it's kind of like a little bit of reverse positive peer pressure. If all your friends are wearing face masks, you're going to be wearing a face mask too. If the super cool camp counselor that you have loved for years is wearing a face mask, you're going to wear a face mask too.
Maybe it's a camp activity.
We absolutely are talking about, like, are we going to tie-dye our face masks? Are we going to bedazzle them? It's a whole thing. You know, just trying to make it as normalized as possible, because once we get over that hump, it's just, you know, I had someone explain it to me in terms of, it's just like you're asked to wear a shirt and shoes when you go into a restaurant. You just wear your face mask now, too. It's just another accessory.
Yeah, I guess so, for all of us.
Yeah.
Also, now I want a bedazzled face mask.
Yes, so. Right?
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today, and good luck with camp this summer.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Devin Yates, Artistic Director at Theater 360 in Pasadena. Liz Kimmelman, owner and director of Tumbleweed Day Camp in the Santa Monica Mountains. And that's it for a bedazzled Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.